Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, my name is Angela Savage, and I'm an award-winning writer and CEO of Public Libraries Victoria. As we come together to talk stories, I acknowledge the first storytellers of this land and their enduring connection to country. I live and work on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and extend this respect to any Aboriginal people joining us. In this podcast, Cautionary Tales, I will be speaking with Deborah Oswald and JP Pomare. Deborah Oswald is a two-time winner of the New South Wales Premier's Literary Award and creator of the TV series Offspring. Her stage plays include Gary's House, Mr. Bailey's Minder, and Dags. She has written TV scripts, 9 children's books, and 3 adult novels. Her new novel is The Family Doctor. JP, aka Josh Pomare, is an award-winning New Zealand author who lives in Melbourne. He is the author of critically acclaimed best-selling novels Call Me Evie, In the Clearing, and Tell Me Lies. The Last Guests is his latest novel. JP is also the host of the podcast On Writing. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, thanks, Angela.
Thanks for that great introduction, Angela.
My pleasure. I'm going to start by asking each of you to provide a brief précis of your most recent novels for those who may not have read them yet. Deborah, would you like to start?
Sure. So my novel, The Family Doctor, tells the story of Paula, who's a much-loved suburban GP. A few months before the novel starts, Paula's friend Stacey and her 2 kids have fled Stacey's abusive husband and moved into Paula's place while they get on their feet. Paula comes home one evening to find Stacey and the children shot dead by the estranged husband, who is still prowling through the house with a rifle, and he then shoots himself in front of Paula. Paula is shattered and she leans on her friend Anita, the other woman in their close friendship trio. Anita's a journalist who covers the criminal courts, and she's wrestling with her own frustrations at the failings in the system that she sees every day. Meanwhile, Paula, the doctor, seizes on the idea that she must protect other women from violent partners, up to the point where she contemplates using her medical skills to kill a man.
Wow. Thank you very much, Deborah. And it is an extraordinary book, and I'm really looking forward to talking more about it with you today. Josh, do you want to give us the elevator pitch for The Last Guests?
Yeah, I hate this question, by the way. I don't know. I guess it's a story about, right at its heart, it's a story about a couple who have secrets, and I don't think that's that uncommon for psychological thrillers. But the premise is, in the very beginning of the story, we learn looking at Airbnb properties and rental properties, and a couple decide to list their place on one of these websites, only to soon discover that someone's installed cameras in the property, and it sort of escalates from there. So it's about surveillance capitalism, and it's about the ways we open up our lives to tech and some of the dangers inherent in what we consider to be a pretty, it's become completely entrenched in our lives. We can't get by without a smartphone, but of course, you know, there are dangers, and it does open up avenues for, you know, for danger. So yeah, that's what the story is about, and there's twists and turns and all sorts in there. But like I said, at its heart, there is a story about a couple and, you know, what we're prepared to accept about each other as well.
And I'm looking forward to coming back to that issue of the relationships in the books. But I think just from those introductions, it's clear as to why the Melbourne Writers Festival people would have put the two of you together in a session, because both your stories could be taken from today's headlines. Obviously different headlines, but they're very, very contemporary stories. And Deborah, I wondered whether The Family Doctor was actually inspired by a specific case of family violence or whether there was something else behind it.
I don't think there's any one case. In fact, the absolutely maddening thing is that there are so many. It grew out of me sitting with the newspaper and the news and every day feeling more angry and heartbroken and helpless about it. And I, so this is kind of a book that's born out of fury. And I didn't know how I could write about the way so many of us feel when we read another story about women, and usually and often her children, killed by an estranged partner. And I didn't know how you could write about that without it just being too awful to bear. And it was only when I thought about welding positive things to it, so the power of female friendship and that urge that so many of us feel to protect vulnerable people. So by welding those two things together, a story started to grow. And in a way, I see it as a kind of transgressive daydream. You know, what if we just killed one of those bastards before they have a chance to hurt anybody? Not that I'm not advocating murder as a solution to the problem, I hasten to add, but I think there's something satisfying about going on that sort of, on following that fantasy through via Paula and the other characters to deal with those terribly dark feelings that so many of us have when we read, you know, so many news stories. I mean, there was no shortage of news stories for me to draw on for the material for the book.
Sadly, yes. And I think it's interesting you say that because there were moments in the book where, reading the book, where I thought, I'm not sure I can do this.
Yes.
Where I was going into some very dark places but I did. I was able to keep reading. And I think that welding that you talk about of contextualizing the lives of some quite traumatized people, but in a broader context of loving relationships, I think was really important and powerful. But I also would suggest that it's not just a mere revenge fantasy. It's not in the kind of scope of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. This is a much more, seems to me a much more moral story.
I hope so. So it was very important to me that there be beautiful things in the book as well, because in a way the bad stuff matters because there are precious things that are threatened, you know, like respectful, tender, sexy relationships between men and women, the glory of little children. These are precious and they have to be protected. So it was important to me that they be part of the kind of flesh of the book. One of the things that I loved about writing it was throwing my characters in these moral dilemmas and hoping that a reader would go along with them a little part of the way, at least, or imagine what would I do in that circumstance, or would I tell of that if my friend had done this. And it's really important to me that it's not a revenge story. One of the characters jokes that it's about preventative murder. And it's also a story where these are regular people. These are you and me pushed by a particular conflagration of circumstances to cross the line. And part of the fun of writing that was working out, well, what would it be like to be a regular person who's done this extreme thing? And in a way, Josh's book explores some of the same territory, because he also looks at the way a person who wouldn't see themselves as doing certain things does a certain thing. And then how does that change them inside, and how do you go on living your life once you've, I don't want to give away story here, trying to be very careful, Josh. You know, once you've crossed that line, what does it look like on the other side? And that's much more fun than writing about psychopaths.
Oh, I couldn't much agree more.
Much more interesting. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, this is the humanity of the characters, the central characters in both your books, is part of what makes them such compelling stories. Because as you say, Deborah, it's easy for readers to put themselves in the shoes of those characters because they're not other, they're us.
Yes, you know?
And so that brings us much closer to the story. Speaking of which, Josh, on that theme of, you know, stories out of today's headlines, you mentioned surveillance capitalism. You know, even since the book's come out, there's been an increased interest in or criticism of some of the social media platforms and their use of surveillance and data mining. Was there something particular that sparked the last guest, that underpinning theme of the last guests for you?
I've had a general interest in the direction we're heading in terms of integrating tech into our lives, and the point at which I'm fascinated by the point at which people will accept that level of kind of integration, you know, for the sake of convenience, what we give up. And I think for me, it was, we had an apartment. I say had after lockdowns, we decided we'd never want to live in an apartment again, but we had an apartment in Melbourne where we lived, my wife and my daughter, and we used to just go away. This was before we had my daughter. We'd go away for a couple of weeks or a weekend here, a weekend there. And we were really just flexible in terms of our work. We're flexible about where we were working from. So I'm a Kiwi. We'd often just duck back to New Zealand. But we started to do this thing where we'd list our apartment on Airbnb. And if it got booked out, we'd just spend that money going to Adelaide or out to regional Victoria or somewhere else. And it was really fun for a while. But I remember at first, two things happened. One, I realized how easy it was to find out about the people who are staying at our property, you know, because you do that. Initially, you're just convinced it's sort of Russian roulette and one day you're going to let a psychopath into your home, you know. But, of course, that never happens. So the first few times you're a bit paranoid, and we were checking up on everyone who was staying, and you just search their name, basically, and you can find their LinkedIn and social media profiles. So that was quite alarming, the extent to which these people were putting their lives out into the world and how accessible it was. And the second thing that happened, after our first guest stayed, and I tell this story a lot, but this is the truth of how the idea came about. So, I think it was an older couple from Adelaide in town for a wedding or something like that. And we wanted 5-star reviews. So we'd leave out gift packages, soap, and I say soap, but like nice soap, like a bottle of wine and stuff. And the bottle of wine was always nice, you know, sort of, as far as we're concerned, nice, you know, $20 plus. And anyway, we came home after they stayed, and there was about, there was precisely one glass missing, you know, down to about the bottom of the neck of the bottle. And they were sophisticated types, so they weren't drinking from the bottle. And the seed of this idea came when I asked my wife, do you think we can drink this wine? And of course the answer was no, but it gave rise to a whole series of questions. And the first was, why not? Why wouldn't we be able to drink it? And, you know, I begin to think of the worst case scenarios. Maybe they put something in the wine and they go, that's not the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is they got the keys cut. And then I go, even that's not the worst. The worst case scenario is they put cameras in. Yeah, and so it sort of escalated. And then I began to think if it was possible and quickly realize it's not only possible, but it's inevitable. And then the course of writing this story started to emerge, you know, and there have been a number of cases now where cameras have been discovered in Airbnb properties, and there's now guides to discovering if cameras have been installed. You can actually buy equipment to detect it, but you can also just check on the Wi-Fi and stuff like that. So that's where the sort of seed of the story came from, was my own kind of tangling with the potential of this technology, tiny cameras. You can install your own Wi-Fi router if you want or use ours. So I was just looking at different ways it could happen and was terrified at how easy it is, really.
And it's always interesting, I think, when you start on something and then the stories start emerging, you have a sense that you're tapping into some kind of zeitgeist when more research is coming out in the course of the work than it was at the beginning. And I think, you know, apropos of that, talking about social issues, it's interesting because crime fiction, thrillers, has a long tradition of social realism. I'm often fond of quoting our award-winning crime writer, Gary Disher, who says, crime fiction is often topical, a barometer of prevailing social tensions telling us about the world we live in. Josh, you've written more than one thriller that engages with social issues, and I'm thinking, in addition to the last guests, of In the Clearing, which features a cult modelled on the real-life case of The Family in Australia. What is it that attracts you to the crime or thriller genre as a vehicle for these stories?
Yeah, trust Gary Disher to have come up with a gem like that. I want to say I was a born crime writer or whatever, but really, you know, in a self-deprecating way, I sort of say that, you know, if I was perhaps a more skilled writer, I'd be much more eager to write literary fiction, because you always think that you can tap into these stories via literary fiction, and you always imagine yourself as probably a more literary writer than you are. Well, I certainly did for years. But what I guess has kept me here, I think with Call Me Evie, I sort of stumbled into crime writing and was edited in a way where we were teasing out the more kind of psychological thriller elements of the story. But I suppose what's kept me here is the fact that, as Gary's pointed out, and you've pointed out, Angela, you can, as a vehicle for tapping into issues you're concerned with, and it comes out naturally. You know, I don't sit down and say, hey, I want to write about violence, inherited violence, and I don't want to sit down and write about the ways you can never escape a cult and what that does to the psychological landscape of people who have been in cults and stuff like that. But these are things that I was deeply interested in, and naturally they just sort of permeate the text. And Gillian Flynn's got a great quote, but I guess it's like Gary Disher's quote, where she talks, and she's the author of Gone Girl and, you know, mega blockbuster bestseller, but she talks about it as a way for, I wish I knew the quote, as a way for affecting sort of not necessarily social change or anything, but but starting conversations about these sorts of things. And she, of course, writes about, less so probably in Gone Girl, but certainly in her earlier work, writes about kind of working class, forgotten pockets of rural America and, you know, the challenges of small town and these places that are getting lost. And she also writes, in my view, she writes about sort of feminist issues as well in these stories. Yeah, so that's my perspective on it, is that you're also reaching a different audience to literary fiction, or even quote-unquote women's fiction or whatever. You're actually, crime is, other than romance perhaps, is like the biggest selling genre, right? So you're reaching an audience of people who want to be entertained. They don't necessarily want to be enlightened. And it's a sort of Trojan horse in that respect, because you can, you know.
Just thinking of, it's very true. It's something that Val McDermott once sent. She talked about her crime novels as being feminism by stealth, because, you know, people aren't going to pick up a crime fiction novel thinking about feminism, and yet her stories are fully injected with it. But I want to ask Deborah, because to my knowledge, The Family Doctor is your first thriller, although you've certainly written in response to social tensions before. I heard that Offspring, for example, came from your frustration that, you know, women were appearing in television programs predominantly as bodies on slabs. But why did you choose the thriller format in particular for The Family Doctor?
Yeah, it's not ever what I expected to do. Look, I've killed a lot of people in my work. Like I wrote Police Rescue, so I've done gruesome industrial accidents to many, many people, and you know, and to many Offspring fans, the killing of Patrick is a huge crime. And I am currently living in witness protection. This is a secret location from which we're recording. I'm still in danger. In the end, for me, this was about the fact that this was a murder I could imagine committing. I never thought I could write about murder from the point of view of a psychopath or from somebody writing out of greed, because I just can't get my head. I'm not interested in that, really. A murder where I thought, I could do that. I can imagine killing someone in that circumstance. That's what sent me down that path. I suppose the thing about my book compared to a lot of crime fiction around at the moment is that it's not a puzzle. It's not a mystery to be solved. I hope it's suspenseful. I mean, I really, really want people to lose sleep. I want
rest
them to stay
assured.
Up.
Rest assured,
keep,
that's it.
You've keep reading it. To see what's going to happen. But the momentum is all forwards. The jeopardy is, here's a person faced with something, they make a decision, then what happens, what will they do when this happens? I hope that you care about them, and so what happens to them next matters. There's a rave by one of the characters in the book about, I'm thinking about kind of procedural murder mysteries on television, and how there's always, you always know that it can't be that murder if it's 9:10 because it's too early. And there's always twists and nothing is what it seems. And this character talks about the fact that in real life, most things are what they seem. And then what the hell do you do? That doesn't solve the problem. So I suppose I hope it's, I know it's, a tricky thing to do, to write a thriller that's not got puzzle elements, if that makes sense. But I hope that there's enough suspense that it will hold. I mean, as Josh said, the idea that you people want to be grabbed by a thriller, and you've got to find ways to keep them with you and keep it plausible and keep them caring about what happens. That's the task, and it's huge fun to do that. I mean, it's not unlike writing television, where you're trying to keep people hooked.
Well, I was going to ask you, because you've written in so many multiple genres, why did you choose to write this story, The Family Doctor, as a novel and not a TV series, for example?
That's a really good question. I think because I felt this urgency about it, and the process of writing television is so slow and uncertain that if there's a story you damn well going to tell, then writing a book and trying to get it out there. I mean, even though publishing often seems very slow compared to television, it's rapid. So I think that was why. I just wanted to get the story down and out to readers' eyeballs as quickly as I could.
Yeah, interesting. I wouldn't have even thought of that. But, yes, it makes perfect sense now that you say it. I mean, is there also an element where you've got more control as a sole author? Because if you were writing television, you'd be in a writer's room, you'd have to kind of contend with
Yes, and you're beholden to the notes from networks, and the sort of power fiend in me loves novels, because you know, you get to choose exactly the right word. The characters say exactly what I want them to say. I don't have actors saying, "Oh, I don't think my character would say that line." So the kind of The control is delicious. Yeah, absolutely.
I want to pick up on that issue that you talked about before about suspense and pace, because both your books are incredibly suspenseful. I wanted to reassure you, Deborah, that, you know, it's a compelling read. And it's interesting. I mean, strictly speaking, there is a difference between a mystery and a thriller. And the thriller is usually that the perpetrator is in plain sight, and the thrill comes from a different kind of momentum than solving the mystery. It's, you know, for working out who's going to, you know, often other people, readers know before other people in the story who the guilty party is. So there's tension created there. Or as in your case, you know, I think there's real tension involved in Paula's decline, you know, her mental decline and that kind of thing. But as I say, both books are tightly plotted. They're fast-paced. They're thrilling. They've both got unexpected twists and turns. I imagine that you have to, well, correct me if I'm wrong, I imagine you have to plan stories like these, that you can't pants them, you can't fly by the seat of your pants. But I'm interested in knowing about that writing process. To what extent did you plot these books out? Josh, we'll start with you. And did anything change unexpectedly in the writing or the rewriting?
Yeah, I mean, this one was pretty torturous to write, actually. And perhaps I've just been luckier with my previous novels. They've all come together much earlier in the process, I think. What happened here was, I think I had this concept that I wanted to realize the potential of the concept. And I think it's not enough to say, well, these Airbnbs with cameras in them, and then the story's something else. Like, it had to be more or less the story. They had to be right at the heart of everything, really. Otherwise, it feels like a bit of a bait and switch for readers. But two, what's the point in having that high concept kind of set up if it's not realized in an effective way in the story? So I went back and forward so much with this that I probably plotted it more than my other stuff, in the sense that I would stop between drafts and really sketch out the kind of outline and really, really think about it. Whereas I think within The Clearing and I'd say with Call Me Evie, there was much less plotting between drafts. It's sort of, I would go through and I would really pants it and let the story fill itself out, and then it would be refining, and then I'd sort of look at what worked, and I'd go into it without much of a plan each draft, and sort of, you know, there might be one or two major plot points I would have considered, but everything else would be quite natural. Whereas with this, I remember actively kind of trying to work out the mechanics of the story a lot more before actually embarking on another draft. And that was also just due to the fact that we were running on a schedule, whereas with my other work, I was so far ahead of the schedule that I had the freedom to really just meander. And I don't know what works best for me for my creative practice, but certainly, yeah, I think it might seem really well plotting that I thought it all out, but it was, you know, each time it's just this thing. I hate plotting because you pull one thread and everything comes undone, you know. So, yeah, no, I would say it's more plotted than my work, but still it wasn't. Yeah, I don't know. I'm quite envious, and Deborah would have a view of this. I'm quite envious of how screenwriting, all screenwriters seem to be so far ahead in their plotting, you know, in terms of at the beginning of the story, they already know where they're going, and it seems anyway, and perhaps I'm wrong, but most authors I speak to, they set out and they have no idea where it's going, which isn't really great when you're running on a deadline.
Maybe deadlines aren't good for your creative practice, Josh. You might have to have a word to your publisher about that. Deborah, would you like to comment on that? Like, in terms of, so you're a very experienced writer in multiple genres, as we discussed before, was The Family Doctor plotted out in advance of the writing, as you would say with storyboarding a script, or was it something that you adapted and changed on the fly?
Well, a bit of both. So I always start off with something like this. I really tried to plot it out because I wanted the disintegration of Paula to be, I wanted to work out the pace of that, and I wanted to make the things that happen, which are extreme, plausible. So you have to kind of work out the steps. And because getting to an ending that would be morally satisfying was quite a tricky balance. So I write file cards and I lay them out on my dining room table and I look at the whole story like a diagram. So I think I've plotted it out. I think I'm being careful. But of course, then when you get into the meat of the writing, the self-delusion that you've got it all plotted out disintegrates. And in The Family Doctor, we switch point of view from sometimes we're in Paula's head and sometimes we're in her friend Anita's head. And that is tricky but really handy for plotting in terms of what we know when and coming back and filling in gaps. But what's interesting is that I think I have it plotted out, but then you'll get into the flesh of a particular scene. And I tend to be a bit of a kind of method writer, like I'll wind myself up into the emotional state of the character, like I'll be shouting or crying or laughing like a crazy woman. And sometimes when you do that, you discover things. You discover, oh, for God's sake, in this moment, of course, she would not do that straight away. She would do this first. And it messes with your planning, but in a really great way. So I feel, for me, it's always holding both things in suspension at once. The plan, so I don't end up going down dead ends and making a mess of it, but also keeping myself alive to the characters. Discovering, once you get into two human beings talking to each other in a moment, the possibilities, the opportunities of that, and the ways I got it wrong with my careful planning. It's a mess, though. It's always a mess.
Actually, you sort of anticipated my next question, which was about your relationships with your main characters. I was wondering, I've heard you talk a little bit about this before, and I think there's some commonalities perhaps between the way you and Deborah approach this. There's a concept in literary theory called the illusion of independent agency, which is when, for writers, when their characters take on a life of their own, like they've almost moved in with their baggage and taken up residence for the duration of the writing. Josh, talk to us a little bit about what your relationship's like with your main characters, whether there's sort of parallels with what Deborah's just said.
You know, I have spoken about this a lot, and I hope it's something I grow out of, or I don't know. It would help save on therapist bills anyway if I did. But basically, yeah, I have this odd thing, and I know I've got friends who are a bit like this as well. In fact, I know Laura Elizabeth Woollett, for instance, is would be even further along the scale than I am in terms of this kind of method writing. And I think hers is much more conscious and a deliberate kind of artistic practice, where mine's just completely kind of random and accidental. But what happens, and so what happened in this book, for instance, is we have Kane, who's an alcoholic gambler. He may not be an alcoholic. He certainly has an unhealthy relationship with alcoholism and self-medication and gambling. But he's also extremely fit. And Lena is also extremely fit. She's a runner and she's always on Strava.
A paramedic too, isn't she?
And a paramedic, yeah. So when I was writing this, I got extraordinarily fit, like as fit as I could possibly get, I think. And I was running every day I think there's one week where I just went out running and I just ran like 28 Ks and kind of wasn't planning on going for a long run. And I'd just do that kind of routinely, go for like a 20K run or whatever. But I was also like, I tried to learn how to gamble and how you could do it online and stuff. So I was actually gambling and drinking a lot. And, you know, it was lockdown. So it's this weird kind of combination of things. And even with, you know, in The Clearing, I went out and stayed out at my brother's house in Warrandyte. And I was just spending a lot more time in nature. I was walking barefoot everywhere. I still kind of do that. I never really shook that habit, but I was drinking lots of kombucha and health tonics and stuff because that's sort of the world that this my character inhabited. And it wasn't really, I think I learned that I do this after Call Me Evie. I think I realized I kind of do it, but certainly I think in The Clearing was when other people would point out that my behaviors kind of changed. And then and I just think it is that thing when you're trying to inhabit a character, as Deborah pointed out, it does happen at the desk, of course. You're kind of pretending and acting and imagining that you are this character, and that's necessary for all fiction. The more you're in that story, and my writing tends to be in these kind of manic bursts of like a month, I'll smash out a draft and then I'll come back to it a month later, and it's really intense. And I haven't done this for a little while, actually, but when I'm right in the zone, I might write for 10 hours in a day. And so that's almost, you know, that's the majority of my waking hours. So if you're forcing yourself to inhabit this character and writing from first person and really trying to imagine their world, the other 6 hours of the day you're awake, you don't necessarily escape that character. So, yeah, I think in the same way Deborah really does have that thing when you're writing, I think it, it kind of sends its tentacles out to the other parts of my consciousness and takes hold. And that stays until usually after the book's out a little bit as
I'm
well.
Just hoping you don't write your next novel about a serial killer, Josh, because I'd hate to see what happens.
I'm writing about a writer. Guys,
oh, thank goodness.
Just a writer. So, and she works in HR. My wife is in people and culture, I guess it's called now. So it's really normal and contained, and they're not real evil people. I just hope this will restore some balance.
I'm pleased to hear that. I'm quite relieved to hear that. Deborah, so picking up on what Josh has been saying, it sounds like your process isn't quite as extreme, but you do find yourself kind of almost role-playing your characters.
Yes. Oh, look, my favourite thing is when you get to go into the world and do real-life research. So, you know, I'm proud to say I have my first employable qualification, which is that I have my TAFE certificate in asbestos removal, which I needed for my novel Useful. The main character becomes an asbestos removal worker. So I went and did the TAFE course and passed the exam. So, you know, I can't do non-friable friable asbestos, so please don't anybody ask me to do that. You know, I love going out into the world and saying to a peach farmer, can I spend 3 days with you wandering around your peach farm and talking to you about it? And it's partly the urge to be a writer is to live all these lives that you haven't lived. But also when you're as old as I am, there's a lot of life experience and observation to draw on. So, you know, I could write Offspring because I selflessly had two children so I could write about it. You know, like, I mean, it's a kind of mixture, isn't it? It's the other thing I really love to do is interview my friends about something so that everybody thinks they know what their friends think. But I will go to my friends and say, if you were in this situation, what would you do? And people will often give you the most interesting answers that you wouldn't have expected. So, you know, that kind of, it's a kind of research, but it's really fun. And then, you know, like there's the internet. I mean, if anyone looked at my Google search history at the moment, it includes what is a lethal dose of hydromorphone? What does it really feel like to be strangled? So, it's a wonder I haven't had people knocking on the door.
Yes, there needs to be a special dispensation for crime writers when it comes to Google search history.
If there's any excuse to go out into the real world, and in a way that the way Josh is talking about, put your body into a situation and think, what does it really feel like to do this? Then that's the fun bit of our job.
And I think, look, both of you have so really, from my perspective, pulled that off so well because you have written utterly credible characters. And just that question, Deborah, that you posed to your friends about what would you do in this situation? I think both those books challenge the reader to think exactly that. What would I do in this situation? What would I do in this situation of surveillance capitalism, of tension, of you know, infertility, all of these, you know, had a desperate desire to have a child in the case of The Last Guest. What would I do in the face of, you know, systemic failure in bringing about justice to women who are survivors of family violence or indeed victims of it? I think both books do this so well, but I kind of want to ask a semi-provocative last question or second to last question, because in putting together this session, the Melbourne Writers Festival team posed the question, how can the suspense of a psychological thriller bring into focus the shortcomings of society at large? And we have talked somewhat about this, but the question I want to ask you two is whether you think psychological thrillers should bring into focus the shortcomings of society at large. Do you have a take on that, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, my view is uncontroversially, I think people should read more books. And so I don't think we should charge all authors with the responsibility of changing the world in any shape. And that's why I'm so against book shaming. And that's why I'm sort of against negative reviews that aren't critical. You know, you know what I mean? Like just reviews that will attack a book for often lazy politics. You know, I think of Honeybee, and there's lots of other examples where the politics are off, they don't align with my view, but I still want to understand if the book's well written and stuff like that. So for me, and I've gone down a bit of a rabbit hole here, but for me, my view is we should be delighted when we find something really interesting or fascinating or illuminating in a psychological thriller. And those, in my view, are the best psychological thrillers, but it's not absolutely not responsibility of the crime writer to do anything other than get people to read and put down their phones, as far as I'm concerned, which in a sense is still a kind of achievement. It's a, for lack of a better word, you know, it's that's still and some to some extent changing society, the fact that you're getting someone to inhabit another character and you're developing empathy and encouraging people to develop empathy. That said, I would say the potential for psychological thrillers is as great as the potential for someone like Sally Rooney. If you think of who's reading Sally Rooney, I think she, for example, has crossed that threshold where she is popular fiction, but as this marvelous kind of literary author. But my sister, who reads 10 books a year, will go buy the Sally Rooney book every year, right? But the other 9 books she's getting would be the big 9 psychological thrillers of the year. So in that regard, Sally Rooney's latest book, if anyone hasn't read it, deals a lot with, well, a number of things, but a real central theme is the fact that, you know, we live in a capitalist society and she's very critical of that and what it means to be an artist and all these sorts of things. And she can get away with that. But I think if you put that much into a psychological thriller, if you're that indelicate about it, because she's pretty direct, then of course you're not going to be a big blockbuster bestseller like those 9 books my sister's reading. So the potential to access huge, vast audiences is there for psychological thrillers, but I don't think you can quite achieve the same thing you can in, say, a literary novel.
Interesting. What's your take on this, Deborah?
I think I agree with what Josh has said. I mean, if I wanted to write a rant about something, I would write it as an essay. You know, because I've always been a dramatist since I was a child, the idea of channeling the things that are bothering me into narrative and into the flesh of particular characters, therefore they can't be kind of slamming out a dogma in a very prescriptive way because real people are messy. That's always been my response to the world, to try and turn it into a narrative. And narrative does something that essay can't do, that a Twitter rant can't do. I think that's powerful, and I think we have to be careful about finger wagging. We have to be careful about ruling things out and diving on people because they've got one thing wrong that we think is wrong. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I mean, I was very anxious with this book that I not write a book from the point of view of a victim when I'm not a victim. And in a way, I wrote a book from the point of view that I'm in, which is the anguished observer, which I think a lot of people are in. So I guess I was careful about where I placed myself in relation to this material, if that makes sense. And I think that was the right choice, but I slightly worry about authors ending up so self-conscious and tangled up that we don't let story rip, you know? Mm. But anyway, that's another whole session.
Oh, yeah, that's another session.
Yeah, yeah. That's real careful. But that does, I think, just adds what Deborah said, that's, yeah, you've perfectly summed it up for me. I think there is something paralyzing about trying to shoehorn in something kind of political or affirming or life changing. You know, just trying to get something in there that can really stifle an otherwise good story. But of course, no one wants to go the other way and completely disregard.
And I'm inclined to agree.
All that stuff is pushing us in a good direction.
And I'm really inclined to agree with what you said earlier, Josh, about, you know, that psychological thrillers, crime fiction doesn't have to bring into focus the shortcomings of society and doesn't even have to take a political position. But personally, I love it when both of them come off. I love that when I've just been gloriously entertained by a read that's also been enlightening or educative in some way. And I think congratulations to both of you, because I think these books, you know, find that sweet spot. Certainly they did for me, The Family Doctor and The Last Guests, really excellent reads. What's next for both of you? Josh, you've alluded to a new book that you're working on featuring a writer.
Yeah.
Another thriller?
After I said that, I realised, so the perspective the story is told from is a woman who works in HR and a man who's a private detective for an insurance company. So like, maybe I am beginning to kind of surveil my friends more closely. No, I just think I realized this when I was driving before. I was thinking how many car lengths you have to be before someone would realize they're being followed. And I didn't even think about the story. I was just sort of driving, doing that, wondering if, you know, the car, a few car lengths ahead of me would notice me. But yeah, so basically the story is, it started off much more speculative, but I've kind of reined that element back a little bit. It's essentially about, I don't even know anymore, to be honest. It's about a couple, it's set in the States. It's about a couple who, one's an academic and one works in HR, and something happens in the town where two girls have gone missing. You don't know what's happened to them, and it's somehow linked to this couple. And there's the private investigators investigating a crash in town for an insurance company to see if it was insurance fraud, but he realizes there's connections between the crash and the disappearances. But yeah,
Have you got a working title for it?
It was called The Memory Surgeon, but that's gone. So who knows what it'll be called? I've got to work on the pitch and the title, and I've got to finish writing it too. So there's a lot
going on. Well, good luck with that, Deborah. What have you got on your plate?
So I'm in the process of trying to develop The Family Doctor into a television series, and I've written the pilot episode, and the producer and I are now in the process of flogging ourselves to the huge streamers of the world. So that will be fun if we get to do that.
Wow.
And I've started work on a new book, but I don't think I should talk about it because it might end up utterly changing.
Sure. No, I respect that.
The great thing for me is because I work in television as well, which is so unknowable and you're at the mercy of other people's timing, I love the fact that at any one time I have a novel that is just mine where the time frame is entirely in my hands. So whenever I'm waiting, I think, oh, fantastic, now I can have a go at that little bit of the book. So I try to keep myself sane more relatively by always having a book, a love project book on the go.
Fantastic.
While I suffer the sort of blows and uncertainty of the evil world of television.
Well, I hope that the evil world of television comes through, because I would love to see The Family Doctor as a series, and indeed The Last Guests too, I think would make fabulous television. But until then, can I thank both of you for today's conversation. It was fabulous to meet and talk about these two excellent works with you, and wish you all the best for what lies ahead.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.